Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. It's May 1857. The Indian city of Shahjahanabad, today called Delhi, is tense. British officers are worried about rumors of insubordination and rebellion elsewhere in India, while the local residents both await and fear a coming storm of revolutionary fervor. Trying to make a living in this setting is Mirza Ghalib, one of India's most celebrated poets, well known for his works in Urdu and Persian. He is also the protagonist, at least in a fictionalized form, of Murder at the Mushaira by Raza Mir. The novel is a murder mystery. A particularly disliked poet is murdered at a poetry recital, forcing Ghalib to play detective, balancing both haughty English officials and passionate Indian mutineers as he attempts to seek the truth. Raza Mir teaches management at William Patterson University in the United States. He has written a few academic books and 3 books of translation and literary criticism about Urdu poetry and poets. Murder at the Mushaira is his first novel. In this interview, I'll ask Raza to introduce both Ghalib and Shahjahanabad. We'll talk about the historical roots of his story, including where he diverges from historical accuracy. And we'll discuss why literary figures like Ghalib are so popular as detectives. So, Raza, thank you so much for joining me today. Perhaps it's best to start with the book's main character, Mirza Ghalib. Who was he, and how did you adapt the historical person to be the main character of your book?
Thank you very much, Nicholas. I am a longtime listener and a fan of sorts, and I'm really, really psyched to be here today. Mirza Ghalib, who is the protagonist of my novel, is perhaps the foremost Urdu poet who lived in Delhi in the mid-19th century, and he is considered somebody who is in the classical mold. But his life really moved from the feudal era of Mughal India into the relatively modern era of colonial India. And so I thought that he was a very good protagonist to chart the rather violent transformation of India into a full-fledged colony, which began after the revolt of 1857. I began to learn a lot about Ghalib. Ghalib was very much a part of my life growing up. But when I became more and more aware of both his personality and the circumstances of history in which he lived, I thought that he would be a great character for a novel. And that's how the novel took shape.
So could you share a few details about the central mystery of the book? What's the crime and what's the mystery to be solved?
Sure. In order to do that, I just want to say that the 1857 revolt, which was a long time in the making in India, really its moment of inauguration can be seen as the point when rebels from different parts of India began to revolt against their superiors, soldiers. And these people came to Delhi on the morning of the 11th of May, 1857, and took over the city. So I thought that would be a point of inflection for the story and just went back to it and created an intrigue where the success of the rebels would be predicated upon a few actions that they took. And I built that into the plot. The central mystery of the book is that a murder has taken place. And it appears that who committed the murder and under what circumstances it was committed provide a lot of insight into whether this rebellion will succeed or fail. So it ends up being a bit of a race against time.
So, As you mentioned, it's set, you know, right as the Indian mutiny is about to start. And in fact, it's when it does start is perhaps the right in between the penultimate and the final chapters of the book. But I guess what actually happens during the Indian Mutiny? What's the political situation like right before it happens? And what's the relationship between, I guess, between Indian states and the British Empire?
Yes, that is a very important question to be tackled as we proceed through the book. You must remember that in 1857, prior to 1857, of course, the British East India Company, which was a multinational corporation, was really administering India. It wasn't really formally the crown that was doing it at that moment. And their area of influence was most prominent on the eastern side of the subcontinent. So Calcutta was their capital. But they had already made substantial inroads westwards all the way to Delhi, where they had their representatives. Notionally, Delhi then, in early 1857, was still the seat of the Mughal Empire. And Bahadur Shah Zafar, the last Mughal king, was considered the emperor of Delhi. Now, of India, in fact. So, at this moment, the backstory is that the British have a plan in place that once Bahadur Shah dies, they are going to formally incorporate the Mughal Empire into the British Empire, or at least into the Company Empire. And the tax collection regime of the British around the mid-19th century intensified and led to a lot of misery, particularly in the rural areas of India. And that was really one of the predominant, motivators of the rebellion. In the city of Delhi, this wasn't clearly apparent. So in some sense, it was business as usual, but there was a premonition of, there was a certain kind of dread that was going through the city, which I tried to capture. And people felt, both on the British side and on the Indian nobility side, that something awful was afoot. And, well, it did come to pass. We know that it happened at a historical level. And the book really sort of charts its happening and envelops them into its plot.
So we've talked about the historical setting, but obviously poetry is a central part of the book as well. Ghalib, and I realize now that I pronounced his name incorrectly throughout the introduction. Ghalib is one of India's most celebrated poets. He's the poet laureate in the book. The story is bookended by two mushairas. And so I guess I want to ask, what is a mushaira and what role did they play in Indian society at the time?
Sure, I will speak to that. But before that, I would say that you didn't really mispronounce it. You know, there's a tremendous amount of latitude that you have with the proper nouns, because in India itself, the cultural diversity of people is such that the way you pronounce a name reflects your background rather than the way their name is actually pronounced. So perhaps the way I say Ghalib really tells people who I am. And you did a very fine job. So to go back to the Mushaira question, Mushairas are these poetic swaris. I just want to say a little bit about the Urdu language. The Urdu language is really a plebeian, a proletariat, a subaltern language that emerged in opposition, perhaps, to some of the officialized languages of its time, particularly Persian in the Mughal court. So the calling card that Urdu had was its poetry. And its poetry was very popular. It was very popular among common people, and it was also popular among people who thought of themselves as literary figures. And so these mushairas were extraordinary events. They would be public events, the equivalent perhaps of our rock concerts at this point in time, where the poets would perform and the public would listen, and it would be grist for the gossip mill long thereafter about who did well and who did better than whom and that sort of a thing. Mushairas continue to be popular even in the 21st century in India. But this was the time when really the Mushaya reached its peak, its apotheosis. And they played an important role in A, popularizing the language, and also B, in terms of connecting various elements of the society together.
And so how did you then work poetry into your actual writing of the story? Ghalib is always kind of quoting couplets at times. Couplets are used as a way to transmit coded messages, to kind of send messages across crowds. But also Ghalib is just quoting poetry all the time. I guess, how did you decide to kind of work this poetry into your telling of the story?
Sure. What I do want to say is that if I may make a very loose analogy, then Ghalib is to Urdu what Shakespeare is to English, in the sense that he wrote a lot and he wrote eloquently, and over a period of time, the turns of phrase that Shakespeare offered the English language became incorporated and got so seamless that many times we quote a line or a phrase or a snippet of Shakespeare without even knowing it. In the same way, people quote Ghalib sometimes consciously, sometimes without knowing it, and there are ways in which his metaphor has become the bread and butter of the Urdu language. And Ghalib was fortunate enough to live long, and his corpus of poetry is big. So I was able to go and plumb his works to find appropriate lines of poetry that spoke to the different situations. Each chapter of mine in the book begins with an epigraph, two lines of Ghalib's poem, which I have tried, obviously imperfectly, to link to my plot. And the Mushaira, like I said, was culturally a slightly distinct place where the British had less entry. So it became a point of some amount of, should I say, cultural resistance even in when people were experiencing colonialism rather negatively. So it was quite natural for me to think of it as a place where perhaps a certain amount of spying and certain amount of communication between rebels could be done without potential British influence. And so I built that again.
So obviously there are many characters in the book other than Ghalib. So I guess who else in your book are either real historical figures or perhaps, you know, composite characters based off of a number of other historical figures?
Yes, I tried to use a lot of historical figures. I mean, the interesting thing about literary fiction is that you can incorporate people who went through history, but the way you characterize them is really something that is up to you. So obviously we have some of the poets who are participating in the Mushaira. They are all real people who have existed in history. Some of the central characters are there. The King Bahadur Shah Zafar is there. A variety of British officials of the East India Company correspond to people who were there, who participated in the 1857 rebellion. And there are a large number of people who are historical, and they are layered with people who are fictional, because I did have to use some fictional figures. But I do want to highlight one figure. There is a woman called Haidri, a young woman who is central to the plot. Now, is she a historical figure or is she a fictional figure? The thing is that she is married to a man called Mohan Lal. Now, Mohan Lal is a historical figure about whom we know a lot. And so I brought him into the plot. I, of course, was able to repurpose his character to my ends. But when I was reading the history of Mohan Lal, I found a single line in one of the historical texts that said, he was married to a woman named Haidri. That's all I said, it was written. So with that one name, I created an entire character. Of course, the character is entirely fiction, but that one name tethers her to history. And you will see the significance, Nicholas, right away, because Mohanlal is a Hindu name and Haidari is a Muslim name. So there was a Hindu who was married to a Muslim, but the person who wrote this historical tract did not find it particularly remarkable. They just mentioned it and moved right along. And that itself is a hint to me that the relationship between, you know, the communities was very, very mature and mutually respectful.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I hadn't realized, and I mean, now that I'm looking at your author's note at the end of the book, that Mohanlal was a real person, and I was quickly looking him up when you mentioned that he was a real person. And anyway, I was kind of surprised by that, and how obviously his historical background is used to flesh out the character in your book. I also want to bring up the British character of Edward Vibart, who is quite an aggressive and not particularly I'm trying to think of the right word, not particularly polite young British official in the book. And as I was doing additional research on the Indian Mutiny for which I was interviewed, I noticed his name pops up quite a few times too in terms of writings on
yes.
the subject.
So if I may look at the British characters along with you, and we can discuss this a little more. To me, the British society, of course, is extremely heterogeneous, and it's got the same sort of class differences and the problems that are there in Indian society. To me, Edward Vibart, young Edward Vibart, represents the extreme negative pole. You know, there are a lot of elements in the colonial administration who thought of the Indians as a subhuman species and took great pleasure in putting them down, you know, rather cruelly and murderously after the 1857 revolt. And Edward Vibart, who is a historical figure, has written rather gleefully about how he, you know, killed a large number of people. So, I mean, I think it's fair to present him that way. On the other end of it is a character called Andrew Watson. Andrew Watson is entirely fictional, but Andrew Watson represents to me the sympathetic end. You know, the British society was characterized of the mid-19th century was characterized by a tremendous amount of exploitation. And so the sort of downtrodden of British society, who were often conscripted into the East India Company's military force, is represented by Andrew Watson, who comes in here and falls in love with the land and in some ways pays the same price that the locals do for his sort of, you know, speaking truth to the administration of the East India Company. There are other British characters who form the spectrum between Vibart and Watson.
So I think I have one more question about the book, or more accurately, kind of the book setting that you present. I mean, you mentioned earlier when talking about Mohanlal and his wife, Haideri, that the historical document that you had did not think it was an important enough detail to mention that it was a mixed marriage, that whatever bureaucrat was putting down that data point did not see that as strange enough to make a note of it. And obviously in the book, it's a setting where relations between Hindu communities, Muslim communities, they understand each other, they respect each other, in what feels like a quite marked difference from how that gets presented today in today's India. I guess, first of all, you know, was there greater, I guess, understanding and coexistence in the 19th century, in the time in which you've set the book?
Sure. I think that the relationships between Hindus and Muslims have ebbed and flowed through history. Sometimes they've been good, sometimes they've been bad, but never have they been inflected by this amount of suspicion and difference and separation that we have, especially in the past two decades in India. And unfortunately, the trajectory in India is towards, you know, a greater amount of separation and a greater amount of suspicion. And I really fear that things in India are headed in the wrong direction. But to come back to the 19th century, it really, I mean, having read a lot about that period as part of background history for this novel, I can say that the relationships between Hindus and Muslims were things that had been worked out at a very, very basic and organic level. People knew exactly how to behave with each other. People would have murderous fights. A Hindu would have a murderous fight with a Muslim, but that the fact that they were different religions would not come up. So that was not something that they incorporated into the way they engaged with each other. Of course, I do not want to imply that religious difference was somehow had disappeared. No, on the contrary, this particular case of inter-religious marriage was possibly the exception. Endogamy is a very important way in which cultures preserve their identity, and endogamy was taken for granted. But really, endogamy was at the level of caste, at the level of subcaste, at the level of region as well. And, you know, everybody negotiated those together. But as far as Hindus and Muslims are concerned, they hung out a lot, they socialized a lot. Everybody knew what needed to be done at different, you know, festivals. And every now and then they fought. Many times they fought over the fact that, you know, two festivals happened to come on the same day, and then they had some dispute about which procession would go in which direction. But the relations were really, really a lot better at that time. I can say that with historical certainty.
So I'd like to kind of move on from the book itself and maybe talk more about you and your writing process and how you thought about writing the book. First of all, again, kind of, I looked into your bio and some of the previous books you've written. You've written on Ghalib before. You've written on Urdu poetry before. I guess, was it different writing about him as in that kind of setting, a more kind of potentially academic, potentially more, well, I mean, a nonfiction setting, rather than as an author of fiction?
Thank you for that question, Nicholas. I have a confession to make. I mean, many first authors will say this. My first novel has been in my head for well over a decade. And that piece, that nonfiction book that you talk about really emerged when I was doing research for this fiction book. Let me just kind of chart out the way in which the book emerged. I tried to think about this, and I read a book called Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. This happened in the mid, around 2005, 2006, I think. It was a it was a very interesting send-up that Abraham Lincoln, who was, engaging in the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation and doing really important historical stuff for the United States by day, was fighting vampires at night. When I saw that, I thought, what a great, neat little idea to take a historical figure and put them in a different setting. And somewhere along the line, I don't know how, that idea morphed into my head as Mirza Ghalib detective. And I began to read Mirza Ghalib's life, and I realized 1857 was an excellent point of inflection that I would choose Ghalib as a person who was not only somebody who went through 1857, but became an integral part of it. And of course, the most important part of writing a novel, since I was trained more as a nonfiction writer, is to find a voice for your protagonist and other characters. And in the act of trying to find a voice for Ghalib, I began to read a lot about him, various biographies in Urdu in particular. And I realized that there was no real book in English that fleshed him out as a human being. And either they were dense academic books or they were translations of his poetry. So I sort of decided that there was a place for a small book that pitched him as a person who was walking through history and whose poetry reflected that. So, long story short, I took a capsule time and wrote the nonfiction book. And in the act of writing the nonfiction book, learned my character a little more. And then, of course, proceeded and finished the book. The book took a very long time to write. I hope my next book will not.
So earlier on in the interview, you made an analogy to that Ghalib is to Urdu like Shakespeare is to English. And there's a different connection there I wanted to kind of bring out in this next question. I quickly looked up how many books have the premise of Shakespeare as a detective. The answer is a lot. There are a lot of books based on that premise. And so, I guess if you had to speculate, why do you think literary figures like Shakespeare, like Ghalib, are such popular subjects for historical fiction of this kind? Why everyone wants to put them into the role as detectives?
I did not know that. I am so happy and so thrilled to hear this. And I'm going to go and find some books of Shakespeare as a detective. There have been a lot of reimaginings of Shakespeare's life, both in book form and in movies. I think the more important thing is that the genre of the murder mystery is very compelling. It's very compelling. There is something about murders, because the finality of it is so stark, that people are drawn towards them. And the murder mystery is possibly one of the most utilized trope in fiction writing in every language. Now, literary and historical fiction is, demands compelling characters. And I think authors make extraordinary characters, but more importantly, Shakespeare and Ghalib, they have so much, in common and in parallel with each other, that I can really see how people would be drawn towards them. What is common to both of them? One is that both of them were relatively poor and, they inhabited the company of rich people. So they were in sort of a subaltern position. Ghalib was the poet who was most regarded by his peers, but he was not the poet laureate. Political intrigue ensured that he only became poet laureate of the Mughal Empire 3 years before the Mughal Empire ended, that is in 1854. Of course, he's the poet laureate when my book is written, but for the longest time, he had to play second fiddle because he had backed the wrong horses in the political intrigue. Likewise, Shakespeare is out there, and when you think of Shakespeare in in the Globe ecosystem, there are people like Richard Burbage and Ben Jonson and others who have the ear of the Elizabethan establishment. And Shakespeare is really somebody whose only calling card is that he is the favorite of the masses, that when his play comes, he is most widely regarded. So one could make an argument that Shakespeare and Galip are beautifully suited for a comparative study. And so I'm really thrilled to hear that he's also the protagonist of some murder mysteries. And when the reviews of this book came out, and I'm not talking about reviews by professionals, but by people who write on Goodreads and things like that, there were many people who said, oh, I had always thought about this. I wanted to write it, but unfortunately now somebody else has written about it. So I think that, you know, people have thought about this sort of genre for quite some time.
So one last question, I think, before we wrap the interview. If someone wanted to get a sense of the history behind your book, whether in terms of the city of Delhi or Galip's work, what should they look for?
Well, if you wanted to read about that period, I think that the best place to start, if you are an English-speaking person, is the books by William Dalrymple. William Dalrymple wrote a series of four books, has written a series of four books, which are peripherally related to some of the events in Murder at the Mushaira. The first one, called White Mughals, talks about the way in which the first initial encounters between England and the British and the Indians was a lot less power inflected. But the second one is the more important one. The Last Mughal is the story of Bahadur Shah Zafar. Bahadur Shah Zafar is the protagonist, and it has a substantial section devoted to 1857. And many of the characters who are peripheral characters in my book appear in Dalrymple's book as well. The aforementioned Edward Vibart also makes a guest appearance there. The third book that Dalrymple wrote was called The Return of the King, and it really talks about Afghanistan. Now, in my book, there is a small segue into Afghanistan. Afghanistan at that point in time was a very important piece of a puzzle between European powers. The British and the Russian and the French were fighting for control over Afghanistan. And as the listeners will know probably, it is referred to as the Great Game. And some elements of my narrative touch upon that. The final book that Dalrymple wrote is called The Anarchy, which describes the East India Company in very, negative terms, and talks about ways in which, it governed India rather violently and exploitatively. So these four books, sort of like an omnibus, provide a lot of historical context. But if of the four you had to read one for the context of this book, that would be The Last Mughal. There's a whole lot of writing around that, but I hope that my book provides enough of context that it can be read on its own without people having to go back and plumb some reference lists.
So thank you for listening to our interview with Raza Mir, author of Murder at the Mushaira. Raza, one actual last question for you. What's your next project, and where can people find your work?
Sure, Nicholas. Before I answer that question, I wanted to thank you for the wonderful way in which you have conducted the interview. I really learned a lot about my book. Sometimes you have thoughts, and when you give words to them, you realize that there's a lot that is still left unsaid. So the book has been popular. The book has become a little popular, And my publishers have wondered whether there is room for something in the same genre. I had been working on a novel that was more contemporary, set in the 21st century. But as they say, owing to popular public demand, I am visualizing a book that really sort of a prequel to this one. Mirza Ghalib, took a trip down to the eastern part of India. He went down the Ganges River and reached Calcutta and spent 3 years on a journey that he took to Calcutta and back. And I am plotting a book that has his trip in the background. Whether it comes to pass or not, I will be able to say in a few months. But yeah, I'm at work.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We hope you're subscribing to listening to the Asian Review Books podcast now on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, and share us with your friends if you want to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us with us for an interview with Dr. Razin Sali, author of Return to Sri Lanka, Travels in a Paradoxical Land. But before then, thank you, Raza, so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you again, Nick.